Picasso knows your vacation home is your best home. It's the place that brings family and friends together. It's where you're the best version of yourself. Picasso makes it easy to co-own a luxury vacation home in amazing locations. Listings start at $200K for 1/8 ownership. Picasso does all the work for you. Luxury furnishings, maintenance, billing, scheduling, and more. And you can resell on Picasso's marketplace anytime, historically for a 10% gain. Visit Picasso to see thousands of listings. That's PACASO.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casual and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick, and today we are back with part two of our series on the beaver.
Yeah, in the last episode, we hopefully gave you a newfound, improved, and reinvigorated appreciation for the common beaver, the world's second largest living rodent and a tireless ecosystem engineer.
That's right. Last time we focused mainly on the real life biology, behavior, and ecological role of the beaver. So if you haven't listened to part one, you should probably go back and check that one out first. I think that will give you a richer understanding of the stuff we're going to be talking about today. But for a very brief recap, beavers are large. They're the second largest extant rodent after the capybara. Beavers have iron in their teeth, perfect for chewing through wood to cut down trees and for gnawing off pieces of vegetation. Beavers, of course, eat vegetation. They're herbivores, and their diet includes foliage, but also the bark and the outer layers of soft wood from tree branches and trunks. Beavers, of course, build amazing structures. They dam waterways to change the characteristics of flowing waterways, to sort of like create ponds and redirect water flow and so forth to deepen water channels. And they also build these essentially impenetrable lodges with underwater entrances and exits for their own housing and protection. And these constructions also allow underwater storage of caches of vegetation to provide food throughout the winter. And then finally, we discussed several studies of what might or might not be considered tool use in beavers. This was a lot of fun, including we had a long digression on the so-called stick displays, where some beavers, in particular populations, this is not common to all beavers of either of the extant species, but this was documented among some Eurasian beavers in Norway. They would pick up a stick and they would shake it up and down while holding it in the mouth and forepaws. The researchers believed this was to demonstrate strength in order to drive away potential antagonists, other beavers encroaching onto their territory. And of course, we ended up highlighting the most impressive of the stick shaking beavers, a beautiful, powerful warrior of the wasteland named Birgit.
Yes, her name, I had to look this up, her name apparently means power, strength, vigor, and virtue.
Wow.
And the other beaver in that study that was not as impressive, but
second
still
place stick shaker.
Second place was Froda. Froda's name means clever, learned, and wise. And this is also, this is related to Frodo. Like, Frodo is like a variation of this name that Tolkien used in The Lord of the Rings.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
However, while the real-life biology of the beaver is truly fascinating, what actually first got us interested in this topic was something you came across, Rob, which was the pattern of deeply off-the-mark illustrations of beavers in medieval and Renaissance manuscripts. Just so far off the mark in depicting this animal, you wonder how it happened.
Yeah, we got into a little bit and discussed how, you know, we have to take into account that while we do have one variety of beavers in North America and the other variety in Eurasia, you know, not everyone would have had direct exposure to it. You have that game of telephone taking place about these species, depending on illustrations and second and third hand accounts. Then there's the added fact that beavers are largely nocturnal. They live out often in very remote circumstances. So the average even observer may not get to observe them that closely. And then, as we'll discuss in this episode even more, there are additional elements of their physiology that may mystify someone who is observing them in the wild or trying to make sense of their bodies as the carcass is processed.
Yeah, another thing, though, is that the Eurasian beaver was once hunted near to extinction. Its populations have bounced back significantly since then, since the 20th century. But it came kind of close for the Eurasian beaver. Like, the hunters really got over on him for a while.
Yeah, North American beavers were also in bad shape. And two of the main drivers for this, one of them was just beaver hats and beaver fur. I'm to understand that the beaver hat going out of style helped out a lot. But there's another major beaver product, a beaver-derived product we're going to discuss in this episode that also threatened these species. These are going to be important, especially when we talk about a particular detail of various bestiaries and illuminated manuscripts that show beavers or alleged beavers. Some of these are very strange beavers. They look more like a deer or a dog or a lion or you name it. But at any rate, the main perplexing detail is that they are depicted chewing off their own testicles whilst being pursued by a human hunter.
I thought we should mention and describe a few of these actual illustrations in the manuscripts they come from. So I came across a post about this on the British Library's Medieval Manuscripts blog. I love the British Library's blogs, by the way. They often are a wonderful resource. But this post is from November 7th, 2012. It's called Beavers on the Run by Nicole Eddy, and it includes a number of illustrations, a couple that we alluded to at the beginning of part one of this series, and several that I think we haven't talked about yet, but none of which have we featured in detail. So the author of this blog post says you can usually recognize a beaver in a medieval bestiary, which seemed at first like a very odd statement, because most of these drawings look absolutely nothing like the real animal, not even a little. But she goes on to explain, you can recognize them because they are always depicted the same way in a characteristic or stereotyped scene, quote, on the run, pursued by a hunter who is frequently blowing a horn and accompanied by hunting dogs. And just as you said, Rob, we can add to that image the fact that they are often depicted either discarding or in the middle of biting off their own testicles while in hot pursuit. Several examples. Let's start with one we briefly alluded to in part one. So this is a miniature from a Latin bestiary originating in England from the second or third quarter of the 13th century. The manuscript is known as Sloane 3544. So what we see in a miniature with the Latin text all around is a sort of rectangle of red background decorated with these three-leaf clover shapes. And then we have what appears to be some kind of big cat, maybe a mountain lion. Compared to the human and the dog in this drawing, it is about the size of a horse.
Yeah.
Also, it has a horse's tail. Did you notice that? It has like a hare tail.
Yeah, this does not even look like a fish tail. As we mentioned before, some depictions of beavers, they often have almost like a mermaid quality to them.
Uh-huh. Of course, beavers do have interesting, unusual tails. They have the flat tail, which aids them in swimming, but they also use for a type of signaling known as water slapping, where they slap the surface of the water to make loud sounds. And this is used for social reasons to signal to the other beavers around them that maybe a predator or a rival beaver from outside the family group is approaching their territory.
I will say this about this this particular quote-unquote beaver. The posture here with rear feet on the ground, front feet elevated, and this tail, as horsey as it looks, it is kind of going down and out, which is at least vaguely reminiscent of the way that beavers will often walk if they're carrying something, you know, with that tail helping them to balance and their front legs are up helping to carry something.
That would be fortunate if that was the artist's intention, but I think what's being shown here is a horsehair style tail, like flapping in the wind as the beaver runs.
If it were not for the, you know, vulgar error, as we'll discuss regarding the eating of the testicles or the biting of the testicles here, this is otherwise, I think, a beautiful image. I like the use of the red, the deep crimson behind it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, but wait, we didn't get to the animal's head yet. So it's got horse-sized body, horse-looking tail, but with feline paws and an approximately leonine head, like a mountain lion's head, but also with a snake neck. It's kind of a dragon, like the neck is curving around and it appears to be covered in maybe feathers or scales. And the neck is curving all the way around for the head to reach back and, yes, bite its own testicles. While the beast is in mid-spring, it's leaping through the air and biting while it's aloft. Its front paws are off the ground.
It is a strange image. Yeah, if you had no background on this, you would just think this is a fantastic creature.
Yeah. Meanwhile, the hunting dog is after it, is, of course, sort of barking, pulling. Maybe, is that a leash? Or I can't quite tell. But there's a hunter also, a dude standing there looking kind of like a hungover George Washington, and he is blowing an upturned hunter's horn.
Yeah, all the eyes in this image look kind of bloodshot, which adds an interesting effect to it.
Okay, next image for us to discuss. This is from a work known as the Rochester Bestiary from England around the year 1230 in a manuscript called Royal 12F. This one is a lot more colorful. Here the hunt takes place on a green hill with a golden sky in the background and trees that look like asparagus. The hunter has blonde surfer hair and wears a blue tunic. He really does. It's kind of surfery, isn't it? It's kind of Owen Wilson hair.
Yeah.
And he's blowing his horn. He's carrying either a sword or a club of some kind in the other hand from the horn. The dogs are howling in pursuit. The beaver is, once again, sort of a serpentine lion with the long, scaly neck twisting all the way back around, biting off the genitalia, but with a different face this time. The beaver's face here is kind of sad and porky, like a lion pig muttering, "Oh, geez, not again."
Yeah, this is another strange one where the beaver looks more like a camel or perhaps, you know, some variation of prehistoric mammal.
Yeah. Now, I want to get into some ones that have more differences. The next one has actually no testicle biting. This is from an herbal medicine manual called Tractatus de Herbis from Salerno, which is in Italy, produced between 1280 and 1310. The manuscript is called Egerton 747. Here, the hunter is a wizard. Isn't that interesting? He's wearing a pointy wizard hat, and he has huge hands, one of which is like up in front of his face, almost as if he's marveling at the hand. Like, how did my hand get this way? What has become of me?
Yeah, this image has a kind of childlike wonder to it, especially when we're describing the beaver.
That's right, right. So, yeah, the wizard hunter has gigantic hands, bigger than his head. He's got his horn slung around his shoulder. He's about to heave a spear. Interesting. I guess there was spear hunting of beavers, maybe. But he's got a spear, like, cocked back, ready to throw it. And then the hunter, the dogs, and the beaver are all standing in what looks like a field of spinach plants. Like, there are these green forking plants interspersed all around. I don't know if that's supposed to be the kind of vegetation growing in the landscape that has been altered by the proximity of a beaver dam. And then one of the dogs is gigantic and the other is not that gigantic. And then the beaver is a horse. And I mean that it's not like a horse. The beaver is a horse. It's just a horse.
Yeah. A kind of shaggy looking horse, with, I believe, visible testicles.
Oh yeah. Not just visible. They're sort of in bold compared to the rest of the illustration. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, yeah.
They're like filled in a darker color than anything else. So the beaver horse is not biting them off, but they're just like, they're very prominent and they're almost perfectly centered in the illustration.
Yeah, maybe the dogs got to him before he could, in this narrative, get rid of them.
Okay, this next one I thought was really funny. This is from another English bestiary, 12th century, in a manuscript called Stowe 1067. It's not fully colored in, just a line drawing. The hunter looks like he's dancing, kind of. He looks, you know, jolly, like he's moving, he's feeling the rhythm. And he's blowing his horn and pointing a single finger at the beaver with his one hand. Do you see the pointing hand? I don't know why that was really funny to me. But the beaver, meanwhile, is a dog. It's just fully a dog, but with one major variation, with weird bulbous eye sockets bulging out of his head over the snout. And we were trying to figure out which Star Wars alien this dog looked like. I eventually realized I was sort of thinking it looks like the dog version of the Zandozan assassin from The Last Starfighter.
Yeah, I can see that. And I was like, something was about this was ringing Star Wars for me as well. So I had the bestiaries, a couple of Star Wars bestiaries out anyway for the Monster Fact I'm working on for this week. So I was like, what is it reminding me of? And I think it's reminding me of Ishy Tib. This is a strange kind of avian or beaked looking creature that's in the background at Jabba's palace, but has also subsequently been used in like comics and on the Clone Wars and stuff like that.
This was one of those where you showed me an image and I was like, oh, I have seen this before, but I can't remember from where. It's really kind of in the background. But yeah, Ishy Tib is like in Return of the Jedi. I found a shot of him like back sort of behind Luke's head while Luke is pointing a blaster at Jabba.
He's not, in my opinion, one of the more interesting Jabba's palace aliens. I didn't have him as a figure, which, maybe that's because I didn't find him interesting, or maybe I don't find him interesting because I don't have the connection with the toy.
Well, anyway, to get back to the beaver in this drawing, which again is just a dog, it's interesting because he's not biting his testicles here. They're floating in the air behind him as if the alien dog beaver has sort of projectile defecated them in the hunter's direction. You see, they're like a floating four-leaf clover in the air.
The four-leafed aspect of the testicle is interesting, and I think that will be of note when we get into the actual anatomy of the lower regions of the beaver.
Now, the examples don't stop there. We could go on naming many more, but I think you get the idea. There was one thing I just wanted to mention further because it's kind of interesting variation, and that's an illustration of a beaver hunt from the Queen Mary Psalter, an early 14th century manuscript called Royal 2B. And in this one, the beaver, again, looks nothing like a beaver, but in a different way. This time, it's just a fox. It's like a gray fox. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it looks like a fox.
The hunter approaches with an axe propped up on his shoulder, and the beaver lies on his back, exposing his belly. Interesting. Apparently, this was another common motif in these medieval illustrations of beavers, in addition to beavers biting off their own testicles. Allegedly, this would happen. They would lie on their back and expose their belly after they had previously bitten them off, or after they had been harvested by a previous hunter and the beaver had survived. So the beaver here is revealing, I haven't got what you're looking for. And then the hunter, in this image, the hunter does look kind of annoyed, doesn't he? He's like, oh, what, for real?
He does. He's got his hand up like, oh, man, chase this critter down in the woods and it doesn't have the goods anymore.
But in the medieval lore of beaver hunts, the idea was that the beaver is clever. It knows what the hunter is looking for. And the beaver is thinking, oh, if I can show off that I don't have what the hunter needs, it won't kill me.
Yeah. Now, this is going to be interesting to reflect on in a bit when we talk about beaver aggression. I can only imagine that this idea of the cornered beaver being a docile creature is an extreme exaggeration and inaccuracy.
So this imagery is obviously a lot of fun, but Rob, would you, I think it's safe to say, I hope you'll agree, that the chomping off, dropping, shooting, projectile pooping of testicles, none of this reflects any biological reality. This is not something beavers actually do or ever actually did.
Correct. Yeah. This is, as we'll discuss in a bit, it's referred to as the vulgar error at times. The error is based on some definite biological realities concerning the beaver, but they did not do this. Yeah, this is not something they did. This is not something I think any animal does. So before we get into exactly why, though, we have to talk about what they were after with all of this. They were after castoreum.
The hunters were.
The hunters were after castoreum, a product derived from beavers. I believe we mentioned this briefly in the last episode, but the basic reality here is beavers keep their hide waterproof via oily secretions from their castor glands. Each beaver, male or female, has a pair of these, along with a pair of anal glands. So far, castor glands, anal glands, one pair of each. This alone makes me think back to that sort of four-cloved testicle that is dropped in one of those illuminated manuscript details we were discussing.
Yeah, that's the four sack that's being chucked at the hunter.
Yeah. Now, I found a great article, a great short but detailed article with illustrations about the glands of the beaver. This is from 1978 by Gerald E. Svensson, and it's titled Castor and Anal Glands of the Beaver, and was published in the Journal of Mammalogy. And it's on JSTOR. It's free to access. If you really want to go in depth on this and see the very helpful illustrations, I definitely recommend it. But the author here says, quote, "These glands liberate odoriferous products that may be used in the construction of scent mounts and in scent communication."
This will sort of connect to what we talked about in the previous episode about the territoriality observed in the Eurasian beavers, where a family group would build a lodge and a dam, and it would sort of police the borders of its area to keep rivals out. And one of the things it would do in order to indicate the borders of its area is do scent marking. And often it was observed that along with the stick shaking behavior, when a beaver felt its territory might be being encroached on by another beaver from outside the group, it would engage in additional scent marking. It would start to mark either with anal glands or castoreum.
Yeah. So both anal and castor glands are in a cavity that the author here describes as being similar to a scrotum, and that, quote, "testes lie anterior to the glands in the distal region of the inguinal canal. The testes protrude into the gland cavity in sexually mature males, but are separated from the glands by tissue of the terminal end of the inguinal canal and the lining of the gland cavity." Okay, I realize that's a lot. And Joe, for you anyway, I included an illustration from this paper that I think makes a little more sense of this. This is one of two illustrations that the author provides. And a reminder, we're very much in the cloaca here.
Right, so in the back of the beaver, sort of between the tail and the hind legs, we have the gland cavity, and it contains these different organs, the anal gland and the castor gland.
Yes. Now, he points out that anal glands are posterior to the castor glands, and each gland opens independently via ducts. So the castor glands, however, don't open directly to the outside. Instead, they hook up to the urethra and open into the beaver's cloaca. However, I imagine this will be key to what we're discussing here. Quote, "contraction of the muscle sheath also forces the papillary end of the anal gland to protrude from the cloaca." I do not think the same is true of the castor glands proper, but again, I'm thinking of basically getting back to this idea of glands, something like testicles, that could be seen as testicles emerging from the cloaca of the beaver, and then it's not there again, you know, common feature of these illustrations.
Interesting.
Though these, if I'm understanding everything correctly, these would be the anal glands, not the castor glands.
But the illustrator doesn't understand it's either one. They think they're seeing gonads and that, like, they're there again and then they're gone.
Right. Now, as for the castoreum itself, I've seen it described as butter-like. Svensson describes it as yellowish, but then it turns brown when exposed to air and sunlight. He shares that urine washes the castor out in a quote-unquote composite mixture that has a pungent odor. He writes that the secretions from both pairs of glands, quote, can be involved in scent mound construction, but that the method of producing these secretions differs based on what we've just discussed. So anal gland secretions are rubbed on something. They're expressed, and then the beaver, you know, gets to rubbing on the rock or the the tree trunk, whatever, while castoreum is essentially urinated out.
Mm.
So beavers use castoreum to mark territory and to waterproof their fur. But since ancient times, humans have found other uses for the substance. To harvest it, it can be milked from a live animal, apparently. I've read that they frequently expel it when handled, though, again, huge caveat here, don't go trying to handle beavers. I'm not sure under what circumstances it is even recommended to do this, but leave it to the professionals. Professional beaver handlers, if they exist, are the ones that need to be doing this. Most of what we're talking about here, especially with these illustrations and historical collection of castoreum, though, involves, of course, killing the beaver, and this requires the glands to be removed post-mortem and then smoked for preservation. Joe, I've included a photo. You can find lots of photos of castoreum that has been dried or smoked. And it essentially looks like some sort, like you might imagine, some sort of like dried up gland, some sort of like, you know, mummified scrotum sort of idea here.
You ever like drop a fingerling potato while you're preparing food and it rolls under the cabinet and you don't realize it's there, and then you find it a few months later when you're cleaning and it's all shriveled up into, yes, like a mummy of a potato. That's what it looks like.
Yes.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more, while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello there. I'm Ann Thompson, editor-at-large for IndieWire.
And I'm IndieWire's deputy film editor, Ryan Latanzio.
And we're the co-hosts of IndieWire's weekly Screen Talk podcast.
Join us each week for an in-depth discussion of the latest in film and TV industry news with special guests along the way, including filmmakers and executives.
Hear from us every Friday morning on iHeart platforms or wherever you get your podcasts as IndieWire shares what we've learned from the movie week that was.
There's a lot of pros to drinking Health Aid kombucha. No cons that I can think of. Pro, amazing taste. Pro, pairs well with anything. Pro, probiotic. That's a literal pro. And it's deliciously refreshing. It's the perfect pairing to your meal or great on its own, whether you're having Pink Lady Apple, Berry Lemonade, or one of the other great flavors. It's the perfect swap for soda or alcohol. Make it part of your daily routine. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid Kombucha today.
Now, getting into this idea of the alleged testicle drop, this has been around for quite a while, and you find mention of it in the works of Pliny the Elder from the Natural History. Of course, we're always turning to Pliny to see what he had to say. And this is what he had to say in the Natural History. This is the Bostic translation. Quote, "The beavers of Euxin, when they are closely pressed by danger, themselves cut off the same part, as they know that it is for this they are pursued. This substance is called castoreum by the physicians. In addition to this, the bite of this animal is terrible. With its teeth, it can cut down trees on the banks of rivers, just as though with a knife. If they seize a man by any part of his body, they will never loose their hold until his bones are broken and crackle under their teeth. The tail is like that of a fish. In other parts of the body, they resemble the otter. They are both of them aquatic animals, and both have hair softer than down."
I love the description of the ferociousness here. Is sort of describing like the snapping turtle reputation. You know, it won't let go until lightning strikes. If you make a beaver mad, it's going to bite until your bones are broken, and basically it's crunching on them like cereal.
Yeah. And this is an idea that I think for many of us might seem comical because we don't think of the beaver as being aggressive. And as we discussed in the last episode, beavers, certainly when they're dealing with other beavers, they have a number of safeguards in place to prevent like actual combat from occurring unless necessary. So you might be wondering, well, is there anything to this? Is this just plenty getting it wrong? Or are beavers truly this ferocious? Well, beaver attacks on humans are rare, but they are not unknown. Rabies can, of course, play a role, but it's not always a factor in these rare instances. We might laugh at Pliny's description, but beavers are, of course, wild animals. They should be respected, and they can be put into situations where they then violently defend themselves. There has been at least one account of a fatal attack on a human in the last century, and I believe in that case it was a situation where they were bit by the beaver and then bled to death.
Mm.
Now, there is a wonderful CBC radio interview out there, if you haven't heard it, from the early 90s, and then I'm not sure the date is known, but it was rebroadcast in, I think, 97, and that's the version that is archived with CBC Radio. It's apparently one of the most requested recordings from the CBC Radio archive. If you look for it, you can find it out there. It is action-packed. It is a little bit funny, but it's also not for the weak of heart.
This interview is riveting. A man describes, he's trying to drive across a bridge in his truck during a heavy downpour, or maybe right after one, and the bridge is sort of flooded. There's some water standing between the concrete barriers on the sides of the bridge, and it appears that a beaver has taken up residence on the bridge. It's sort of swimming back and forth in the water. The man gets out of his truck because he is afraid he has accidentally hit the beaver with his truck. And when he gets out, the beaver angrily latches onto his leg and proceeds to attack him multiple times. He sustains, it seems not life-threatening necessarily, but pretty serious-sounding injuries. Like the beaver bites, and it bites hard.
Yeah, like bites him like 11 times, and he's just fighting it off, trying to get back in his truck and drive off. I think he has to hit it with a propane tank at some point. And yeah, it's a violent account, though I have to stress that the man telling the tale, he has a lot of sympathy for the beaver. And at the end of it, he's like, it's my fault. I'm the one who, I thought I hit it and I should never have gotten out of the car. It was just out of the truck. It was just defending itself. But it really drives home that yes, if the beaver is cornered, the beaver can be ferocious. Those teeth can dig into you, and you can easily see how in another situation, if the beaver had got him in just a few different places, he could have easily bled to death before he was able to drive himself to the hospital. I also like how the individual in this story, he's quick to add, it's like, I've been bit by just about every animal out there, but I'd never been bit, or I've been attacked by just about every animal out there. Been attacked by a wolverine. one imagines a moose, but never a beaver.
Yeah, but I am, like you said, impressed by he holds no malice for the beaver even after the attack. I think he just keeps saying he was on defense.
Yeah. so definitely seek that out if you're interested. But back to the Pliny document here. One of the notes on this text points out that Pliny derived this description from the physician Sextius, and the text goes on to remark on the vulgar error here. And mentions the work of the French naturalist Cuvier. Quote, Cuvier remarks that when the gland becomes distended with this secretion, the animal may probably get rid of it by rubbing the part against a stone or tree, and in this way leave the castor for the hunters, thus giving rise to the vulgar error. Now, this is interesting because going back to what we just discussed, it's easy to get the two confused here. What we're talking about here, what they're rubbing would be the anal gland secretions, not the castor. But still, you can imagine this situation where you'd have something distended from the lower end of the beaver, something that may look from a pair of glands that may look like testicles. Here's this beaver going up, rubbing itself against a stone or a piece of a tree branch or something, and then oh, lo and behold, whatever was protruding is gone. This could be the thing that, quote, gives rise to the vulgar error.
Yep, that does make sense. And it connects again to the idea of the scent markings being territorial boundaries in nature, you know, trying to ward off encroachments by other beavers often. So it makes a lot of sense that, say, if a hunter is coming into a beaver's family group territory, the hunter might see it marking.
Now, Pliny also mentions the beaver again in the Natural History when discussing the sea cow, which he says has a similar level of intelligence and a similar alleged defense capability. Quote, and this is talking about the sea cow, it vomits forth its gall, which is useful for many purposes in medicine. Also the rennet, which serves as a remedy in epilepsy. For it is well aware that it is hunted for these substances. Theophrastus informs us that lizards also cast their skins like the serpent and instantly devour them, thus depriving us of a powerful remedy for epilepsy. He says, too, that the bite of the lizard is fatal in Greece, but harmless in Italy.
Okay.
Now, there is some merit to what Pliny is saying here, generally, because certain creatures are thought to leave behind parts of their body or vomit something as a distractor for predators. We also know very well that not just humans, but animal predators sometimes target specific organs of their prey. But what he's reporting about the beaver here specifically is not true. But I also find this interesting, this is a tangent, the idea that the lizard eats its skin after it sheds it to spite us, to be like, nope, this you're not getting your hands on my sweet skin. When, I mean, in reality, we know that many lizards, including my son's gecko, consumes its own sheddings because, like, you're not going to waste that good stuff.
Of course not. Yeah, nature is full of disgusting efficiencies. But to add a little bit to what you said a minute ago, it is absolutely true that, there are many animals that will self-amputate when threatened by a predator or under various stressful situations. This is a strategy known as autotomy. A-U-T-O-T-O-M-Y, comes from the Greek for self-cutting or self-severing. You can often see it like in lizards where, yes, if a predator, say, grabs hold of their tail, the lizard will just release the tail from their body. The predator can have it, which has a double effect that's helpful for the lizard's survival. For one thing, if it is grabbed by the tail and then releases the tail, it has now escaped the grasp of the predator. But the other thing is, by giving the predator a sort of consolation prize, it's almost like compromising with them. It's like, well, you can have this much, but you can't have my whole life.
Mm. Now, it's also worth noting that I think all the examples of this that come to mind are essentially ejections, releases. They do not involve like active severing of a creature's own body with its teeth or its claws or that sort of thing.
Well, yeah, that's a good question. All of the ones I can think of having read about before, yeah, just seem to be severings often of like a tail or a leg or something or a claw. Mm-hmm. But that is a good question. Are there cases where the animal has to work on its own autotomy, where it essentially must do the severing itself with its teeth or claws or other something like that?
Yeah. So if the beaver were to sever its own testicles, it would be really an alarming behavioral development. I can't imagine a situation where a creature would develop, it like evolve to have this as an actual feature of like dropping their testicles, like ejecting them. Because, even examples like certain scorpions that eject part of their own tail and in doing so eject their anus, and then can no longer poop, as we've discussed, and then just kind of swell up with poop for the rest of their lives. If memory serves, they can still reproduce. They're not giving up reproduction, that vital act of any species, in order to protect itself.
I did think of a possible counterexample. I wish I had read up on this deeply before we started recording, but I believe there are cases where crabs will practice autotomy, and that will involve the, like, cutting or pulling of the autotomized claw with the other claw. So that is like active, like the alleged beaver testicle biting.
Ah, we'll leave it to crabs to do it that way. Yeah.
Maybe we'll have to come back to that in listener mail or something.
Mm-hmm.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello there. I'm Ann Thompson, editor-at-large for IndieWire.
And I'm IndieWire's deputy film editor, Ryan Latanzio.
And we're the co-hosts of IndieWire's weekly Screen Talk podcast.
Join us each week for an in-depth discussion of the latest in film and TV industry news with special guests along the way, including filmmakers and executives.
Hear from us every Friday morning on iHeart platforms or wherever you get your podcasts as IndieWire shares what we've learned from the movie week that was.
There's a lot of pros to drinking Health Aid kombucha. No cons that I can think of. Pro, amazing taste. Pro, pairs well with anything. Pro, probiotic. That's a literal pro. And it's deliciously refreshing. It's the perfect pairing to your meal or great on its own, whether you're having Pink Lady Apple, Berry Lemonade, or one of the other great flavors. It's the perfect swap for soda or alcohol. Make it part of your daily routine. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid Kombucha today.
All right, now coming back to castoreum, the origins of human uses for this substance are, of course, lost to time. They emerge from somewhere in the vast period of time during which our ancestors determined how best to process and use an animal's body for resources that range from like the really practical, like meat and materials, to things that are more cultural, like decorations and adornments, and also that often murky area of medicinal and magical properties in a given substance. But still, we have some early sources to consider. Now, apparently, the ancient archaeological evidence of castoreum usage by humans takes us back a good 6,000 years. I was looking at a paper titled Ancient Throwing Dart Reveals First Archaeological Evidence of Castoreum, published in the Journal of Archaeological Science Reports. This was in June of 2021 by Helwig et al. And basically, this throwing dart in particular was found in the Yukon Territory, and it featured a red-orange residue that, upon analysis, contained the various organic ingredients and materials that matched up with beaver castoreum. Mm. The authors point out that the substance was seemingly used to toughen wood by ancient hunters, though baiting and medicinal uses among later First Nations people were also recorded. The Tahltan people, in particular, were said to use it on the heated wood of their bows and kept some on their person in a small container of like wood or horn or bone. So it sounds like it was something that was probably used to like to maintain your weapons, to maintain your hunting implements.
Hmm. As a kind of oily treatment for the wood.
Yeah, yeah. Which, you know, this to a certain extent, I guess, kind of reminds one of how the beavers use it to help use that special claw comb of theirs to comb it into their fur, in addition to using it to mark their scent.
Mm-hmm. But in the fur, it's supposed to have some waterproofing purposes.
Yeah, yeah. Now, Sarah Lohman, in a 2017 article for Mental Floss, it's a nice overview that points to a number of different additional alleged uses for castoreum. For instance, I believe in Roman times, it was thought that you could use like a smoke inhalation based version of it for as an abortive medicine. 12th century mystic Hildegard von Bingen wrote that it could be powdered and put into a wine to reduce fever. And then in colonial America, it was used for all sorts of stuff. It was used as both a means of staving off sleep, you know, sort of like your your trucker speed, I guess. But it was also used to encourage sleep. You know, having a little insomnia, well, all have right. some Castoreum. It was used as a kind of brain booster. You know, you're feeling like you need to up your game. Well, you can't just grab some brain booster pills at the grocery store. You need to go get yourself some Castoreum from the local apothecary.
They must have gotten really smart.
Yeah. It was used to treat colic, to treat gout, and to treat toothaches and earaches.
Now, I got interested in the idea of the use of Castoreum allegedly to treat pain because of something I read. Unfortunately, I was not able to find a very clear answer on this. But what I read was that I was looking at a book called Aspirin and the Salicylates by K.D. Rainsford, published in 2013. Quote, salicylates have also been identified in beaver castor, i.e. of scent glands, from where it is secreted instead of the via the usual urinary route. The salicylates are probably metabolic transformation products from vegetable sources in the diet of the beaver. So that kind of interested me because salicylates are related to the active ingredient in aspirin. Aspirin is, of course, it's a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drug often used to reduce fever and treat pain, inflammation. And this active ingredient in aspirin, acetyl salicylic acid, is derived from a precursor found in the bark of the willow tree, which, of course, is something that beavers tend to chew and eat a lot of. So this chemical relationship with the active ingredient in a common non-steroidal anti-inflammatory and pain reliever made me wonder if there could be some kind of connection there. Like maybe this downstream animal product that's derived from this original plant molecule, I wondered if that could be playing a role in Castoreum actually having an anti-inflammatory effect or treating pain, but I could not find anything solid to back up that connection. So I don't know if there's actually anything to that, but my curiosity is raised here.
Yeah, that's interesting. Now, outside of alleged medicinal properties, it also has a long history of being used just for its scent and as a flavor enhancer. Lohmann notes, as others have noted in these other sources we've looked at, that Castoreum, once processed, you know, smoked or derived into a tincture, it can be used to enhance flavors, particularly to enhance flavors of raspberry and strawberry, to replicate a kind of vanilla flavor. And it's also been used to give perfumes a sort of leathery odor. And I guess all this shouldn't be too surprising, again, realizing that the compounds in Castoreum are ultimately derived from leaves and tree bark. So it shouldn't be completely shocking. Now, it's still technically an FDA-approved natural flavoring in the United States, but it's rarely used and was far more commonly used as a flavor enhancer in the early 20th century. Now, if you've looked around at anything about this, you may have come across this. There is apparently a Swedish spirit called Beaverhut that uses Castoreum, translated as beaver shout. Some adventurous imbibers have sought it out. You'll find a number of spirit and alcohol bloggers out there talking about their experiences with it or doing videos. Some of these with kind of crude titles, but I found a really nice one on a blog from an individual named Dolly Jorgensen at dolly.jorgensenweb.net, who has like a very nice historically driven post on the subject that is, again, far classier than what I was seeing in other places online. I just want to read a quick quote from Dolly Jorgensen about trying out beaver shout. Quote, the first flavor was similar to oak-cured whiskey, but then the musk comes out. It's a hard-to-describe taste, but I imagine that it's what traditional male musky cologne would taste like. It was not particularly strong, however, so it seemed pleasant enough to consume most of the shot. An hour later, however, I had a different opinion, as the Castoreum scent started to seep out through my skin, literally. My pores started to extrude the musky smell.
Okay, I mean, that's a commercial, basically.
So I thought that was telling because the way the author describes it here, it's probably, or at least in this case, and I guess it depends on who's making the liquor and so forth, but it sounds like it's more tolerable than you might imagine, but there being this kind of like after effect to consuming it. If any adventurous sorts out there listening to this episode have experience with Beaver Shout, do write in. We would love to hear from you. We'd love to hear your impression of this.
You know, this reminds me of the time we talked about the liquor that had a human toe in it, and then we heard mm-hmm. from multiple listeners who said they drank it.
Yeah. There was another blog post that I was looking at where the individual was like, hey, it's kind of a hobby of mine to find various alcohols that have something organic in them, some part, and then try it out. And you see this in different cultures, like the idea of like some sort of alcohol and it has like, I don't know, a snake in it, a scorpion in it, that sort of thing. But in this case, the castor glands of a beaver are used to create a unique spirit. I also looked around. I was like, maybe somebody's making a cocktail with this. Maybe there's a Beaver Shout cocktail out there. I could not find one. So if mixologists out there are figuring out a way to sort of tame the flavor of Beaver Shout and like sort of manipulate it into a more refined concoction, I have not found evidence of it. I went to Imbibe magazine and looked around for Castoreum, and nothing was coming up. And that's the one place I would expect, like some professional mixologist out there has whipped this up, you know, as a challenge, but I saw no evidence of it. Maybe in Sweden, maybe it's like a special thing. You need to like look to Swedish high-end bars to find this.
Maybe you got to ask Birgit where to find it.
Yeah. All right. Well, I believe we're going to close out our two-parter on the beaver here. But this was a fun one. This is one that initially I was thinking we would discuss some of these images of the beaver in an episode that looked at other inaccurate depictions of animals from various bestiaries. And then it quickly became obvious that this was an entire episode and then that it was actually a part one and a part two. I have so much more respect and admiration for the weird and wonderful beaver now.
How can you not? I mean, if you don't, they'll shake a stick at you.
Yeah. All right, we're going to go and close it out here. But we'd love to hear from everyone out there. If you have thoughts, experiences concerning the beaver, write in. If you want to check out other episodes we've done in the past, we've covered a lot of curious animals over the years, kind of composing our own bestiary in many respects on the Stuff to Blow Your Mind podcast. You can find core episodes of that on Tuesdays and Thursdays in the Stuff to Blow Your Mind podcast feed. On Mondays, we do Listener Mail. On Wednesdays, we do a short form artifact or monster fact. And on Fridays, we set aside most serious concerns to just talk about a weird movie on Weird House Cinema.
Huge thanks to our audio producer, JJ Posway. If you would like to get in touch with us with feedback on this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for the future, or just to say hello, you can email us at contact@stufftoblowyourmind.com.
Stuff to Blow Your Mind is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Hello there. I'm Ann Thompson, editor-at-large for IndieWire.
And I'm IndieWire's deputy film editor, Ryan Latanzio.
And we're the co-hosts of IndieWire's weekly Screen Talk podcast.
Join us each week for an in-depth discussion of the latest in film and TV industry news with special guests along the way, including filmmakers and executives.
Hear from us every Friday morning on iHeart platforms or wherever you get your podcasts as IndieWire shares what we've learned from the movie week that was.
There's a lot of pros to drinking Health Aid kombucha. No cons that I can think of. Pro, amazing taste. Pro, pairs well with anything. Pro, probiotic. That's a literal pro. And it's deliciously refreshing. It's the perfect pairing to your meal or great on its own, whether you're having Pink Lady Apple, Berry Lemonade, or one of the other great flavors. It's the perfect swap for soda or alcohol. Make it part of your daily routine. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid Kombucha today.